This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 379 for May 26th of 2017. Toyota puts fuel cells in semis. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Gary, we're back at it again.
We are. It's a big week in Detroit.
Ooh, we got a lot to talk about.
We sure do. Unbelievable.
Yeah. What a hot and heavy week this has been. We also got to tell everybody we got Craig Trudell from Bloomberg. And Craig, great to have you on the show here, man.
Thanks for having me back.
And you got, what, just back from Japan, or how long have you been back now?
It's been a few months now. I got back just before the end of the new year after about 3 years in Japan.
Cool. So, and I got to believe you love being there, too.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to getting back in the next few months. Let's
How's your Japanese? It's got to be semi-decent.
Not very good.
Okay. Well, you know, let's let everyone know, too, that our special guest for this show is Sheldon Brown. He's the Executive Program Manager for Advanced Fuel Cell Projects at Toyota. Sheldon, great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Big fan of the show.
Oh, cool. That's always cool to have a fan of the show on the show.
That's right.
Big trucks. Isn't that what you're working on? You guys got a deal with the Port of Los Angeles, or is it Long Beach to do trucks there with fuel cells?
Yeah, well, really, it's not so much a deal, but we recognized, obviously good relationship with the ports down there. We obviously have
bring in a lot of Toyota cars there, right?
They certainly do. We have our facility in the Long Beach area, and we recognize that right now they're dealing with a big problem there. There's a sort of a confluence of all these, diesel trucks and diesel boats and diesel equipment and diesel trains all sort of in one central area. And obviously, they have a lot of issues with pollutants. And there's not just the greenhouse gases, but they talk about the criterion pollutants. And specifically, when we talk about diesels, there's NOx and SOx and PM2.5. And so those
issues. The real nasty stuff.
That's right, exactly. And within that area, third party sources, have confirmed that because of this high concentration, they have a lot of airborne respiratory problems in folks who live in around the area. So the port was looking for obviously ways to improve that, and they've done a lot in their clean transportation initiatives. We sort of looked at it as an opportunity to say, is there something that we could apply, and does our technology work here? And really, from our perspective, it was an opportunity to look at our fuel cell application and what and how might we do that. So we sort of started this project as sort of a skunkworks project. It was sort of below the table project, and we kind of said, okay, well, what might work? For a long time, I think we have said, and you've probably seen our graph, it sort of shows travel distance versus vehicle size, and we sort of show electric vehicles kind of here, and as we sort of progress, we move into the hybrids and the plug-in hybrids, and as we move on up, we've talked about fuel cell in the bus sectors and in the large vehicle and the longer range. And so from a conceptual standpoint of view, this project was a proof of concept. What if we took a single Mirai fuel cell with, a scaled battery and motor? We took two of those, two motors, two batteries, and if we could start at the high end, at the heavy-duty sector, we could show that this really was a scalable technology. And so made most sense, Class 8. Let's start with the top. So 80,000-pound GVW, if we can do it on that, we can move it on down the road. So that was sort of the genesis of this project.
So, when you say port, I think people may not have a sense. I mean, I never did until how large these things are. So, so what kind of scale are we talking about here?
In terms of the port size you're talking about?
I mean, why you would have a Class 8 truck driving around a port.
Yeah, so, It's unless you go there, I'll be honest with you, we read about it on paper, and until you get there, we're talking about when you see those large ocean containers, right? They're called the intermodal, containers. They go from a ship, they're about 20 feet to 40 feet long, 8 feet high, or 8.5 feet high, 8 feet wide. So these are what's coming in off of all these ships. They have these giant cranes. The longshore operators are pulling them off of these boats. They're then getting moved on to trains to go to all different locations around the country. And then right now, if you can imagine, they're somewhat landlocked. So in many cases, these go onto trucks that take them to regional distribution centers. And then in some cases, they just have to get them off of the port area, right, you know, where these ships are coming in, to get them out to these distribution centers. So just to kind of think about this, a Class A truck, this is the traditional semi that we see. If you live in the Midwest, you see them carrying these van trailers, right? They're the big box trailers that are built in. That's not what you see in Los Angeles. You see the dolly trailers. It looks like an I, a capital I, and that's where they set these containers directly on these, and they're moving them. If you go up and down the 710, you will be a car among a sea of trucks. It's a totally different world. Just to give you an idea, I think in 2015, something like 16,000 Class A trucks move in and out of the port of Los Angeles, Long Beach per day.
16,000 per day?
Per day.
That's a lot of trucks.
That's a lot of trucks. And so that's just expanding.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit more about the execution of actually pulling off this project. My understanding is PACCAR had a little bit of involvement with this as well.
To be perfectly honest, this is something internal to Toyota. We funded it completely. In fact, we really didn't even tell the port that we were working on it. But what we did do was we went out and actually through a third party, we purchased a
Kenworth.
A Kenworth, yeah, exactly, a T660. And so we went through there. We bought it as a glider. And then we...
I.e. no powertrain.
I.e. no powertrain, that's right. We didn't need it, so we figured no sense in paying for it, right?
you can do that with trucks. You can buy them without engines.
You sure can, yeah. And let's be honest, on these development projects, budget is a little hard to come by sometimes. So, yeah, we use that opportunity. But, yeah, we took this and we literally took the components that we took off of production Mirais, and we basically packaged them. We had to develop new fuel tanks. We had to develop a set of motors, a transmission, and some batteries. But the rest of the vehicle is really legitimately production Mirai components, including many of the power electronics. So we put those in. We packaged them. Obviously, before we got that far, we did a little bit of modeling to make sure that, you know, this sounded better than just an idea on paper, and there's a little bit of validity to it. But, yeah, we brought them together, and then... at that point in time, we went through and developed the vehicle. It took us about, from the time we really started, the real packaging, got the green light to spend the money, about 12 months, about a year. And then we spent the next 4 months validating and making sure that we had sort of hit our numbers. And right before we introduced this back, I think it was on the 19th of April, we did bring PACCAR and their executives just to let them know, hey, we've used your vehicle, and you know, just sort of as a courier, a courtesy to let them to, you know, tell them, hey, this we've done this, and we'd like for you to see it. And certainly, you know, looking down the road, you know, if there's an opportunity to collaborate, you know, we've left all those doors open, because right now, you know, we're just in the proof of concept phase right now.
Sure. So when I think of the Mirai, I think, you know, I've driven it, and mm-hmm. and I mean, it's no Hellcat. I mean, it's not going to blow the doors off of anything. But when I think of a Class 8 truck, I mean, it is so massive, and you say, okay, two fuel cell stacks from the Mirai.
That's right.
Okay, but presumably you had to develop different motors to get more out of them?
That's true. So basically, if you think about it, we produce about 114 kilowatts of energy out of a Mirai fuel stack. So we put two, so we're in that 230-ish round range of energy coming out of our fuel cell. Then we develop two batteries that supplement it. So we talk about our total power of our motors are putting at about 500 kilowatts or 670 horsepower. And again, what we wanted to show here was the scalability concept, right? So if I take one Mirai and one motor, I can put it into, let's say, a full-size pickup truck. If I wanted to take one Mirai or take two Mirai, then I take the same two motors, marry those two motors, take the same battery now, put two batteries here. So the idea is it's scalable and it's stackable. And then as we sort of shift down through, the concept would be, okay, now we just adjust the size of the batteries and potentially the size of the motors. We apply this to a Class 6 application, like your UPS truck, if you will, those type of different motors. So again, trying to, you know, use the fuel cell as a commodity that we can, you know, put into a large range of different vehicle types, and then obviously we can drive down the cost of fuel cells, and we can proliferate the usage of them, and you know, this all starts to lend itself towards, you know, this idea that if we want to develop the infrastructure for hydrogen, we have to develop the demand, and we have to show that the product is capable. And that's really what this was sort of our first real stab at. I think we've shown its production capable in Mirai. Now, how do we apply it to different applications? Mm-hmm.
Elon Musk says he's going to do an electric semi. Does that make any sense to you at all?
Well, you know, certainly not going to second guess Elon. He's proven that he can do things very, very well. Right. You know, I'm not one that necessarily thinks that it's all or nothing in this new alternative technology market. I think the electrification of the powertrain is something that's coming. I think it's important. And I think that how you go about electrifying it is just the same way we have, you know, diesel application and gas application. Certain things are going to lend themselves better one towards the other. When you start to talk about the Class 8 trucks and you talk about capability, as it stands today right now, we're not aware of the battery technologies that are, you know, out there that we can put without, you know, massively impacting the amount of weight that, you know, that they contribute to the overall GVW. The comparison right now, completely retrofitted, runs at about 21,780 pounds. The comparable, I'll say, 232-inch wheelbase with a sleeper cab, because we're the same size as a sleeper cab, but we've sort of replaced the sleeper with our hydrogen storage, runs about 22,000 pounds. So we're
right in the ballpark, within 1,000 pounds.
So from that perspective, we haven't really compromised the ability of the vehicle. And the other great thing about the fuel cell right now is, you know, we can fill it in 20 to 30 minutes. So, you know, that's the reality of the situation.
Well, it takes that long, 20 to 30 minutes. What would a diesel tank, twin tanks taken to refill?
Probably less time, and then it depends. If you're at a trucking station where they have the high-flow diesels and you're able to plug in both sides at the same time, you can probably do it in probably less than half that time. Mm-hmm. But if, you know, you're at a standard diesel pump, you know, it would take on par with, you know, with an automotive-size, you know, diesel pump, right? The Flying J stations and some of those ones that are set up for trucks, they come in, they have the ability to push, you know, walk in, put one side in, come to the other side, put the other side in, because they're going to hold, about 220 gallons, some of those long haul. Hmm. But we're not focused on long haul. We're really, part of the reason why we picked the port is drayage. You know, these trucks, most of these trucks don't go more than 150 miles in a day. In fact, very few do. If you do it, you're probably only doing one haul, because you're basically coming out of the port and you're going maybe to like Ontario, where they have a big regional distribution center. And that round trip is, by the time you get into the port, get loaded, get out, get there, get unloaded, and come back, you might be able to make a small little loop in and around the port. A lot of the places are, you know, 15, 20, 50 miles, you know, loops where they're literally taking these containers from point A to point B, to like a peel-off yard, or taking it from the port directly to a rail center. So this was a natural fit for us. Again, we don't need to dominate the world in this particular market, but really focus on an area where it plays to our strength. Less than 200 miles a day, the ability to refuel after an 11-hour shift, and then the ability basically to have a lot of trucks in the small area. So when we think about, you know, the infrastructure, makes a lot of sense, right? And what else is in these ports? Refineries. What if refineries make? Hydrogen. Mm-hmm. It kind of is a perfect storm right there for us.
Interesting.
Well, I guess applying this, you mentioned actually not letting the port know right away that you were doing this project. Once you did bring in the port and bring in the state of California, mm-hmm. can you talk a little bit about the reaction to this and what sort of chances there may be to take this from sort of a proof of concept to something that actually gets applied here?
Well, I mean, both the state and the port, if you look at our press release, we invited the folks there and to the reveal, and I think we got a lot of positive feedback. I think they're excited because obviously it's a giant boon to the California economy to be able to expand the port and to be able to do it in a very responsible way, and that is to reduce a lot of the pollutants that kind of come hand in hand with increasing the amount of trucks. And you know, they're at kind of a point where they're landlocked, right? So as we imagine, you know, the number of, you know, units that are coming through, what they call them, the TEUs, 20-foot equivalent units, sort of how they measure the throughput. As those expand, and their plan is to do that aggressively through 2030 through the documents that they produced, that means that there's going to be more and more trucks. So we're at 16,000. We could imagine 30,000 trucks being in that area. So I think we've got a lot of support. Obviously, they have within the state, have started a lot of their own clean air or clean transportation initiative, they have, you know, provided funding for others to look for alternative, or I should say zero emission solutions, whether that's battery electric or hydrogen fuel cell. So certainly they've been supportive of that, and you know, internally, again, Toyota took this on as really our internal challenge, and before, you know, we like to make sure that, you know, at least that we're comfortable with the technology, and that, you know, the idea has been somewhat vetted. And to be super clear, you know, we're a long way from commercialization. This was, you know, the first step, right? And we're aggressively going after, you know, phase two. But duty cycle is going to be important. And before this can be, you know, we've looked at the lessons learned from the integration of CNG and of LNG. Some of these trucks got brought in. Great efforts were made for all the right reasons. But in some cases, we found that, you know, durability and total cost of ownership weren't thoroughly vetted. And you got a lot of industry negativity in these new alternative technologies because they, you know, sort of once bitten, twice shy. So we really want to do our due diligence. And if we're being 100% honest, this is not our primary sector, right? So one of the reasons that we have this proof of concept is to get out there and to actually run these daily routes, to pick up the data that you can only guess and imagine and really not understand until you've really done the duty cycle. And so as we take that and we build that, we're going to look at how that impacts the product. And really, we have to be, you know, paying very close attention to efficiency and total cost of ownership, because we've talked to all the operators, and while the port really loves it, you know, at the end of the day, it's the individual or the companies that own the trucks that are the ones that have to turn the margins, and they said, you know, what's the most important thing? And it was total cost of ownership, total cost of ownership, total cost of ownership, total cost of ownership, right? So,
and I'll bet you got the picture.
Yeah. Right, so.
Hey, look, we got a lot more to talk about, sure. But we've got to take a quick break right now, because we got to give a shout-out to our good sponsor, Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking with Truwood Brown all about fuel cell trucks at Toyota. And we got a question here from one of our viewers. GM Veteran wants, he's got a couple of questions, but sure. One, he wanted to know, if you ever commercialized it, would it be the Hino truck brand or the Toyota brand?
That's a really good question. And the truth of the matter is, I don't think that we've actually really decided that yet. And the truth be told, we're way too early in this process to come out that. If I were to sort of prognosticate and think, you know, we probably want to be a little bit agnostic to the concept. I think we recognize that our strength right now is providing a fuel cell powertrain. So, you know, we could imagine where we would do this in a way that's, you know, less disruptive and offer it to a lot of different, you know, companies who might be interested, may that be PACCAR or Volvo or, you know, organizations. As we think about how regulations would have to change and as zero emissions comes in, there's going to be trucks that are, you know, mid-cycle through their 10-year cycle life. So our feeling is this system applies itself to brand new installation, but also if you needed to go back and retrofit, so your upfront investment isn't as great either, right? So, you know, you got a powertrain that's, you know, 500,000 miles, you can pull it out, put this in, but at least your truck and your chassis are still, you know, viable. So it helps reduce that sort of burden on the initial adopters in those early phases.
What is the range of this? I mean, and is that just predicated on tank size?
Well, yeah, tank size and efficiency, right? Those are kind of the two things that we're looking at. And again, our numbers, you know, this is a really unusual project to talk about, because we're knee deep in it, right? So when we go back out and we look at the numbers, I might have a different number for you tomorrow. But our initial assessments, we're hitting our 200-mile range, and we're probably doing a little better than that.
So these are actually working at the port right now?
They're not actually working at the port right now. We have them right now still going through what we call mileage accumulation. I should say we have it going through mileage accumulation. The truck. We're doing that on-property testing, just making sure that we're real confident. We target around probably mid-June to end of June, and we'll be out ideally working in Los Angeles in the ports. We still have a little bit of work to do with partnering with someone there to make sure that we're working in and around the port is pretty complex.
Yeah.
There's a lot of players involved in that. So we're talking about how do we maneuver and operate and do so in a way that is beneficial to us from a data collection standpoint of view, but obviously isn't disruptive to the, you know, to the businesses who are operating in that area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we got another question here. Kevin Fetty wants to know, how is the fuel economy of a Class A hydrogen truck measured, tested, and benchmarked? And he also, he knows that the exhaust is really water. He wants to know if you can drink it.
Well, we certainly don't recommend that you drink it, but it's fairly pure. Anything that goes through a vehicle, I don't know that I'd immediately go and put it into a glass of water. Now, if you're in the middle of the desert, broken down, it's your last resort. Hey, you know, I'm not going to say yes or no, but you know, it's up to you. How is it measured? And that's a great question. Right now, in a lot of these alternative fuel cell systems or these alternative powertrain systems, we don't necessarily have that. But there is a University of California, I believe it's Irvine. I think it's Irvine, has a dyno, and they do, I'm not, sorry, it's Riverside. Anyway, they have a dyno, and they basically have drive cycles that are part of this. The port has been working with academia to develop a duty cycle, so that you know people can actually take their big rigs, whatever their powertrain is, put them on there and do an A to B comparison. And so they have multiple different drive cycles that you can run through. And so that's one way to give us an A to B comparison, because now it's very difficult to talk about fuel economy. You know, fleet operators have pretty good numbers that they use, and that's just because they're running trucks every single day. But you know, they're running that's sometimes a mix of cross country and sometimes you know longer runs versus port and drayage. But you know, so you see anywhere from about 5.5 miles per gallon diesel up to some of the new diesels you've heard reports as high as 11 miles per gallon. We're not quite there yet. We're about 6.5. But again, this is, if you can imagine this proof of concept, the original premise was this isn't going to work. Right, so first was show that it works. Refinement is what we are going to be focusing on now in efficiency improvement. Mm-hmm. So I think right now we're running. We've met our 200 mile range under full fully laden. And again, that's another thing. You know, when you're in drayage, you don't know what you're going to be hauling. Sometimes you'll be hauling heavy containers. Sometimes,
boxes of cornflakes.
That's right. You got it. Exactly. So it's a little difficult to really dial in a real number on that right now. Mm-hmm. So
have you looked at the Nikola One truck that...
I'm familiar with it. Yeah. We've seen it. Yep.
Yeah. In fact, a GM veteran was asking about that.
Yeah. Have I looked at it? Yes, we've certainly looked at it.
Because it's another fuel cell truck, right?
It is, 100%. It's a little bit more of a different approach, right? It's a ground up, right? It's rethink how a Class 8 truck ought to be built, right? It focuses heavily on aero, and it focuses on, obviously having an integrated drive train that's integrated into the rear drive axles as opposed to, the traditional drive system. They're a little different, though, right? Because if we think about how do you apply, we're a fuel cell hybrid. We think of them as a fuel cell range extender. So they're hybrid, right? But they put a large battery. I think they may have said 380 kilowatt hours or something to that extent, if I recall.
Yeah.
And then they're using a fuel cell to sort of, supplement that battery and recharge it. So they're, if you think of where is their primary mode of energy coming, it's coming out of the battery. Our case is exactly the opposite of that. We are primary. So when we're doing 60, miles an hour driving down the road with 80,000-pound GVW, we're sustaining ourselves with the power that's coming out of our fuel cell. And we have our batteries, only 12 kilowatt hours, relatively...
Pretty small.
Really, really small, if you think about that, right? Like, smaller than, other BEVs.
So basically, the electricity is coming out of the fuel cells that's used to drive the motors, which are used to drive the wheels.
That's right. And as soon as we get to that hill, battery comes in and supports, or we have that ancillary load when we... Or if we want to drop our fuel cell, to run in a more optimal condition... We supplement with a battery, and then we recharge those batteries.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit different approach.
We're talking about this truck project today, and we've only sort of glossed over the Mirai, but mm-hmm. could you talk a little bit about the state of affairs for the Mirai, the state of affairs for the charging infrastructure in California, sort of where Toyota is at, and is it satisfied with how the charging infrastructure is coming along and the Mirai introduction is coming along?
Yeah, I'm certainly not the product expert on Mirai, but certainly we're selling Mirais as you expected in California. I think our release into the East Coast has been a little bit slower than we would have liked, and that's largely due to infrastructure. And you mentioned charging, and I just really hydrogen fueling is really our issue.
Right?
Sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, just no worries. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. And
yeah.
So I think a real big success we've had is I think perhaps in February you saw we have partnered now with Shell. And now we have a real energy company.
Shell's very committed to hydrogen.
Yeah, they've really that partnership was really exciting for us, because now we're talking about really helping to proliferate that infrastructure, especially within the California area, and the East Coast is a large priority as well. It's alternative powertrains. It's a chicken or the egg battle that goes on, all the time. We can't invest in infrastructure because we don't have demand. We don't have demand because we don't have infrastructure, right? So we're always battling that. It's an interesting concept, but if you think about heavy duty, why heavy duty is so appealing from an infrastructure standpoint of view. Again, just thinking about the port, heavy, heavy concentration of this equipment. And let's not kid ourselves, there's fuel cell forklifts, a lot of different applications, right? They have a lot of diesel that goes in there. So they can electrify that. Sometimes it might make sense to do some charging or electric, having electric electrification of the equipment might make sense, but that's all infrastructure upgrades. So really being able to put it into a local area and to drive demand obviously helps us reduce cost, and it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. we'd like to think.
So is this, you're mentioning the possibility of Class 6 trucks, you know, the UPS trucks, and so their routes are fairly deterministic, and, mm-hmm. you know, they come back to a spot where you could have the refueling infrastructure right there and sure. to keep that going. So, I mean, is this part of your idea, and, you know, and to the point of the Mirai, I mean, it's pretty expensive compared to a Camry,
sure.
right? And a lot of that is just strictly the fuel cell and how expensive it is because you're making so very few of them. So is the idea here that, you know, maybe you'll be able to increase the output of fuel cells, drive the price down, and then get a proliferation of vehicles?
I think the natural sort of progression is to think about that, right? Think about, you know, buses, airport terminals, areas where we have folks that, you know, have relatively small range, comes back to a general location where we can have high concentration or density. Having said that, I hate to poo-poo the, because we're excited about that, right? I want to talk about this is how we're going to dominate the world. But really, the first step right now is
proof
really
of concept,
make sure,
right?
Yeah, and now it's really vet that, make sure that we're really there, that we really have the right technology. So that's our real focus right now. I hate to promise, you know, the world right now because we haven't gotten there. But I mean, that's sort of the natural progression, right? Starting to think where it'll be, you know, school buses, garbage trucks, things that sort of work in you know, common routes that sort of fall in those general areas, those all sort of lend themselves to this type of technology.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got a couple of quick questions here before we wrap up the segment. SubGR77 wants to know if your truck's got regen braking.
We have very limited regen braking currently. That's the beta truck that we're talking about. Obviously, that's a huge opportunity for us. In fact, we talk about total cost of ownership, the ability to utilize regen and to dial it up and down, especially, you know, people don't like Jake brakes. Most of the time they can't use them. They're a very effective means of controlling 80,000 pounds when you crest a bridge and on your way down. We do have, I'll call what's very similar to like engine braking currently, which would just be, you know, off throttle and in the natural drag. But again, with a 12 kilowatt hour battery, we don't have a ton of place to put it. And it's amazing the amount of energy that an 80,000 pound vehicle rolling down a 6.5% grade puts out. So we're working now on and how do you manage that energy? And then what do you do when your batteries fill up and how do you utilize that energy? But it's absolutely one of the greatest things about these electric powertrains is the ability from, you know, to reduce the load on surface brakes, to improve braking performance, because let's not kid ourselves, these trucks, that's a huge...
If you're a fleet owner and you got to do brake maintenance, that's a big item on your cost list.
And the ability to stop them faster, you know, because that's a lot of mass. And, you know, you start coming down grades or you get into a traffic situation, now we can utilize the motors to help slow down the vehicle as well. So it's an interesting avenue.
Okay, Dan, who was the phone call that we're having technical issues, can't get it in here, but I'm going to paraphrase with it. He wants to know, is anybody making hydrogen from renewable sources? Because most of it comes from natural gas now, right?
Well, yeah, the gas reforming is probably the most economical means to produce it at this point in time. And I think there's a lot of studies that are out there. A lot of different people are looking at how to do that, different concepts, right, utilizing methane from different sources. Obviously, you can use solar and electrolysis. It's a viability. It's not quite where it needs to be in terms of efficiency. But, yeah, that's, you know, those are the next steps, right? We need to talk about both of these things in tandem because the technology, if it does prove out to be as successful as we like to think it can be, the next step is to making sure that we have the energy readily available for everybody.
That's right. Last question that we've got here from the guest, Jesse Henry, wrote in, and he wants to know, how stable is fuel cell output in temperature extremes compared to batteries?
Well, I think that's absolutely one of the best things we have about a fuel cell in terms of one of its win-loss categories as we compare it. You know, effectively, once we start operating the fuel cell, we can operate in all different types of climates. We don't see a reduction in energy output. We do have to maintain a specific temperature, you know, certain temperatures. So some inherent energy is lost to keeping that the fuel cell warm. But as you know, like in the Mirai, it's real simple. We just close off with a three-way valve, and we don't run it through the radiator anymore. And we keep recircling it in a shortcut circuit, right? And so that way, we're able in those colder climates to maintain temperature. So far more efficient. We don't have the same problems.
Okay, next step in your program, what do you do?
Well, you know, next step is take the project. We've announced we'll be out and operating out in the public and really working with the port and some operators to gather data.
And I'll bet the operators are going to love how quiet this truck is.
You know, that's one of the things that we haven't really talked about, but is the you talk about the other great thing about this is we've gotten rid of this diesel engine. And right now, the thing that stands out is the brake compressor, the air compressor for the brakes, because there's nothing to mask it.
So
it turns
the loudest.
On. Yeah, right? But it's for the truck operators. You lose the vibration, you lose the noise, and you lose being around all of the the diesel fumes. So as you're sitting there idling, waiting to get in this line of 15,000 trucks to get into the port, a lot of health benefits to the driver as well.
Sheldon Brown, this has been fascinating.
Thank
you so much for coming on the show today, and I can't wait to see these trucks in action. I think it's going to be awesome.
All right, well, we really do appreciate it, and I'd love to have you guys down someday. We'll get you down to the port and give you a ride. So
that's a deal.
All right.
Okay, real good.
Thanks again.
Well, thanks very much. Audience, don't go away. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be talking all about the news that have been coming out this week in the automotive industry.
This is 37 Seconds in the Autoline Garage.
Whether it's the spindle grille or space-age styling, you may not like the looks of the Lexus 350 RX F-Sport, but the inside of this performance-oriented CUV more than makes up for any exterior hiccups. And it starts with a comfortable cockpit with the luxury elements you expect from Lexus. There's also a 12-inch display that's almost as wide as the RX itself. Plus, there's aluminum trim throughout. There are, however, a couple of curiosities in the car, including an all-too-sensitive remote variable interface, or do you say mouse, and a great-looking heads-up display that contains a compass that looks a lot like it belongs somewhere else.
This has been 37 Seconds in the Autoline Garage.
Okay, we're back, and this, of course, is the time of the show, as I put a lot of drama in
you
my voice.
You do put a lot of drama.
For Dr. Data!
Okay, so this one, I thought the pattern of the numbers was very, very interesting. And so, as you may not know, Craig, that you try to determine what it is that this number represents.
Hinting at, yes.
Okay, so Carmen, could you please bring the first slide up, please? Okay.
So 2012, 18.7 million. 2013, it drops to 16.2. 2014, it jumps back up to 18. 2015, 17.4 million. Now, I would think it would be like the SAR, but I see that there's bicycles in the background.
Okay, what do you think, Craig?
Yeah, 18 and change does seem too high for SAR, so I do think, yeah, maybe bicycles sold. I'm with John and maybe cheating a little bit with the graphic here.
Man, we're going to have to get these graphics more blurred, because last week you got it on the first one, and then you got it on the first one this time. So, Carmen, please bring up the answer. So the U.S. sales of bicycles. But, I mean, you look at those numbers. I mean,
it's very similar to car sales,
and it really surprises me. And what is also surprising to me is the fact that as we're coming, closer to us in time. So this is the sources, the National Bicycle Dealers Association, and that's the most recent figure that they have for 2015. But with more bicycles being talked about, it would seem to me that number would actually be growing rather than decreasing,
mm-hmm.
and it's a bit of a surprise. So, but not as big as a surprise as what happened in Dearborn, huh?
Oh my God, yeah. The Mark Fields being given the heave-ho here.
So 1 week ago we were talking about.
Yeah, I think Mark is safe. But we were talking about, there's a lot of controversy. I told you last week that I heard the rumors that he might be thrown out going back to October of last year. But I figured, hey, if he's gotten this far, he's good to go. So it caught me completely by surprise.
So for those who aren't following this the way we're following this, so Mark Fields, the president and CEO, retired and is replaced by Jim Hackett, who 56 had...
56 years old, right?
Yeah. Fields was 56, replaced by a 62-year-old.
Jim Hackett, who is now the president and CEO. And then there were other changes. So Jim Farley, who had been running Europe, is now the executive vice president and president of global markets, so marketing guy, right? Joe Heinrichs, who had been running the Americas, is now the executive vice president and president of global operations.
Mm-hmm.
So these are two new positions, right? Marcy Cliffhorn is now the executive vice president Executive Vice President and President of Mobility, another new business within Ford, right? Mark Truby is the Vice President of Communications, so Ray Day is out. Raj Nair, who had been running product development and was instrumental in the Ford GT.
Very instrumental.
He is now the Executive Vice President and President of North America.
Big, big move up for him.
Sharif Markabee, who had left Ford and gone to Uber, is now back at Ford, and he is the Vice
President. Year, right?
Yeah. Well, anybody leaving Uber probably is glad they are.
So he is the Vice President of Autonomous Vehicles and Electrification. Hao Taitang is Executive Vice President of Product Development and Purchasing.
Now, so he had purchasing.
And now he's added product development.
Which I think is a very incredible move. That's going to be fascinating. I think that's a real smart move.
We talked about the GT, Hao Taitang was behind the Mustang.
Right.
Right.
You shouldn't forget.
Right. And Ken Washington, Executive Vice President for Research in Advanced Engineering and Chief Technology Officer. So that's a new addition there, too.
But I thought he had been doing that.
I think
was he just VP and now he's what, EVP or Senior VP?
Executive Vice President.
Okay. I think
but
that's
last
the
bit of his title is what's new, right?
Right. He had been doing advanced engineering, and now he's Chief Technology Officer as well.
I thought he was CTO.
I think Raj had the Chief Technology Officer before. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Huh. All right. So one of the things that was said was that Mark was insufficiently communicating the vision of Ford. And I got to tell you, did Mark Fields for the last 2 years, have a presentation to the public where he didn't talk about autonomy, didn't talk about mobility, didn't talk about, changing the nature of the company? I mean, I thought that guy was doing a great job in terms of talking about that. I mean, what happened?
I think Keith Naughton at Bloomberg, our reporter who's been following Ford for decades now, I think he really hits the nail on the head here, and his reporting showing that it's very significant and very important for Mark Fields to have a relationship with Bill Ford, and that's what his sources are telling him, where things have sort of gone wrong, and even just over the last few weeks that we've seen that what Keith had been hearing was that just over the last few weeks that relationship was really showing signs of strain. So I think ultimately this job, you're a hired hand as the CEO of Ford Motor Company. You're reporting to the Ford family, and Bill Ford is pulling the strings. It's really important for the CEO to articulate what's going on with the company, but also to be in cahoots with Bill Ford and allow Bill Ford to come out and talk about the future of the company and the direction of the company. And what Keith had heard as well was that perhaps Mark and Ray perhaps were not necessarily incorporating Bill to the extent that Bill may have liked.
So it was a personal thing more than
It also doesn't help that the shares were down 37% during his tenure, right? That's we just calculated this morning, actually. That was $25 billion in market value over the course of his less than 3 years that was gone by the time he was done. So I think that's a very significant portion of the story as well.
Yeah, Craig, just to echo what you're saying, that's what I had heard, that Bill Ford and Mark Fields were not talking to each other. Mm. If they had to, they did. But other than that, there was no communication between them. And to get back to your question, too, Gary, I think you're right. Every time he turned around, you heard Mark Fields saying, Ford Motor Company is going to be a car company and a mobility company.
And showed bicycles.
And he showed electric bicycles even, right. But what I also heard is that Wall Street, they heard the same thing, but they didn't hear the business case. And this is where the communication fell down and communicating to the street of, yeah, we're doing all this stuff, but here's where it's going to pay off for the company. Not in this gauzy kind of, future vision, but in hard numbers. Here's where we expect to be able to make money on it and how. At the same time, we preserve the old business, the traditional business, and don't let our earnings deteriorate. That's the problem. They kept the old traditional business running. They were investing in all this other stuff, and their earnings went to hell.
Well, they also, I think a good case could be made, too, that even the traditional business has kind of slipped a little bit. I mean, Ford had no business letting the Expedition or the Navigator go as long as they did untouched. And honestly, that some of that lies with Alan Mulally. You had Alan Mulally emphasizing small cars, right? And at that time, that looked like a pretty smart bet back in 2008, 2009. That was where Ford needed to go.
In the U.S. then.
That was a huge hole, but the market really kind of pulled the rug out from under Ford's feet. You had also the Bronco. I think Ford would absolutely love to have that before 2020 or 2021, as they've talked about. So it's really a matter of show me on the traditional business side, and I think on this new mobility side as well. I think electrification. You know, where is the Chevy Bolt at Ford? Nowhere to be found, and probably nowhere close. I think they've talked a lot about this vision of how they see the future, but they haven't had a lot to show for what Ford is up to. They've been a little bit tight-lipped about what they've got going on behind the scenes.
Okay, I have a question for both of you guys. So Jim Hackett has basically been with Ford, running Ford Smart Mobility for 1 year. Okay, he'd been on the board before that, but I mean, if you're on boards, you're on boards, right? Okay, so he'd spent the better part of his career at Steelcase, okay, which is an office equipment company, right?
So office furniture.
Office furniture, sorry. So my question is that on the one hand, you've got to shore up your conventional automotive business, cars and trucks of a normal nature, and you've got to create this new mobility infrastructure. Okay, doesn't he have a fairly steep learning curve on both fronts? So how are we going to see results from that?
Well, I think you absolutely have a very steep learning curve, and maybe that's why you're seeing this situation of, I think the way the company and Hackett described the situation was one of faster decision making by elevating these people beneath him, shrinking the team, but having Henricks and Farley, you know, veterans of this industry who know what the heck they're doing, really empowering them and giving both of them a huge amount of things on their plate. I mean, you look at what they're responsible, it's very lengthy what's now on their plate. So you have those guys as the operators, and Hackett now is sort of the guy who has to, along with Bill Ford, articulate the vision and articulate where Ford's going in the future. So
yeah. I think we're going to see quick changes, big changes. And we've seen some just today.
They reorganized the company.
Right. But, you know, look at what General Motors is doing. Really hard-nosed business decisions. Pulling out of Europe, pulling out of South Africa, Australia, India. Still manufacturing, but pulling out of the market. Russia.
Thailand, right, I think?
I think they're still in Thailand.
Didn't they just announce today that they're going to be reducing their headcount in their...
Singapore.
In their international headquarters.
Yeah.
That's right. But this is how one of the ways in which GM has kept the old business going, invested in the new business with no deterioration, in fact, improvements in its earnings. And I expect to see Hackett having to make very quick moves. I mean, these management changes, I think, are the first step. I would expect to hear of them pulling out of markets where they're not making money and see no hope of ever doing so. And the other thing that Ford's being criticized for is GM's got like this fleet of 100, I think it is, Chevy Bolt EVs running around in California that are autonomous. Ford's got some stuff going on in its campus, and that's about it, even though they started on this way before General Motors did. I don't criticize Ford for not having an EV right now, because, look, you're going to lose all kinds of money on them.
There's such a thing as being too early on that. Nissan Leaf.
The Ford electric car is not going to be out until late 2019 or 2020. Just when everybody else, Tesla, General Motors, and the rest, have exhausted all their federal tax credits, boom, Ford's going to come out with its electric car, probably at a rate of development where they're not going to lose all kinds of money having brought it out. So I'm not criticizing them for that, but the other stuff, yeah, I do understand why they're being criticized.
Right, and I think with Ford as well, you'll also maybe start to hear a little bit more about Argo AI. You mentioned GM and Cruise and the Bolts that they're testing. We heard this sort of big whiz-bang announcement earlier this year about them hiring these guys who come from Carnegie Mellon and were a part of sort of the birth of the autonomous car with the DARPA challenge and whatnot. These are some really smart guys, but they put $1 billion into this what was at the time a two-person operation, right? And they've understandably not had a whole lot to say about what those guys are up to. So presumably we'll hear more about what Argo AI is up to. Because Ford's going to want to turn the attention away from, you know, sort of the carnage and start, you know, looking to tell a brighter story.
This is an AI deep learning company that,
right.
And it was $1 billion over 5 years, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Unlike the Cruise Automation, where they put a $500 million in, like, here.
No, I think wasn't Cruise $1 billion, and their investment in Lyft was $500 million.
I think it was more like $500 million in Cruise.
Right.
But you may be right, John. Anyway, there was serious jackwheel, however you look at it,
and they just stuck it in there.
A ton of money. I think what was going on with Cruise was maybe an initial $500 million that they said was going to increase over time. So, but certainly they're not pinching pennies with how much they're plowing into that.
So what happens? I mean, so you can make all the management changes you want. You can put in new furniture. You can print new business cards. You can do all this stuff, right? But at the end of the day, they have to have cars and trucks that ordinary people are going to buy. Okay, is this going to make an effect on that?
I think it's hard to think that there's going to be a significant change. It's just not the way the automobile industry realistically works, right? I think we're still going to see the fruits of what Mark Fields was working on, or what Ford was working on under Mark Fields for some time. I do think you'll probably see a change in direction of the way they tell their story. That's a very easy prediction to make when they're changing the guy who's heading communications and changing the CEO. But I think you'll perhaps see Bill Ford back out talking a little bit more, and you'll see a sort of attempt to get Jim Hackett out there pretty quickly. I think Ford is very aggressive in telling their story, and I got to believe that they're going to be out talking more about Hackett's time at Steelcase. I think they already did that this week, talking about Bill Ford talking about going on a little field trip with the board last year and talking about, you know, these Silicon Valley guys immediately approaching Hackett and giving him a hug. And he talked about that as...
He sold him a lot of furniture.
Yeah. One of those customers, by the way, was Steve Jobs. So that was one of the...
Jobs was dead last year.
Well, yeah. Before that. Right.
So Apple actually went with Steelcase while Hackett was at Steelcase and switched from Herman Miller. So,
But, you know, I think Hackett's going to benefit, like you're saying, Craig, of a lot of the groundwork that Mark Fields laid. You know, remember, right now, Ford is at the absolute bottom of its product cycle trough. You know, they have had nothing new for quite a while. The only thing new this year is the Expedition and Navigator, and they're years late, as you pointed out. But, you know, Ford's got passenger car-wise, just in the U.S., I'll talk about, you know, Fiesta Focus, Fusion, Taurus. Four passenger cars in a market that's walking away from passenger cars real fast. You don't need four of them. You know, I would expect a Hackett to come out and decide we don't need a new Taurus. We're not going to invest in that. In fact, Fiesta, can we ever even realistically make a penny on Fiesta? Even in global markets, maybe we don't invest in that either. You know, maybe we only need two passenger cars. That's it. Now we can free up money to go do other things. And if they start talking about that, at least to the analyst community, because the dealer's hair will go on fire when they start hearing this stuff. But he's got to communicate how he's going to strengthen the core business, invest in the future, and not let earnings deteriorate.
Now we know you're a Michigan State guy,
and we won't hold it against you.
One of the things that kept being brought up about Hackett was that he was the athletic director at the University of Michigan and brought Jim Harbaugh.
Right,
Ann Arbor, which is like bringing, the live relic
it's
of a
the second
saint.
Coming
guy
right?
walks on water.
Yeah, exactly right. So, FCA got sued this week by the Department of Justice for a diesel problem, and then we heard today that there's a class action suit being brought against General Motors, including 705,000 Duramax diesel trucks. So what's the deal with diesels?
Right. I think these two stories, while they rhyme, they're very, very different, right? You have a case with Fiat Chrysler where the EPA first came after them in January. This is a follow-up to that where the Department of Justice, this was a case where the EPA referred this to the Department of Justice, and you saw over the course of the last few months, you've seen negotiations between EPA and Fiat Chrysler to kind of come to an agreement on a way to resolve the EPA's concerns with these diesels that didn't come to pass without EPA saying, you know what, forget it, we need to refer this to justice. So Fiat Chrysler is in deep here. I think you've seen their response to this evolve ever so slightly, where initially they just outright denied it. Marchionne was very, very colorful back in January, calling this hogwash. And now you've seen actually Fiat Chrysler say that they're going to defend themselves, and they didn't knowingly or intend to did not knowingly flout the laws or intend to flout the laws. So there's sort of an implication here that at this point maybe Fiat Chrysler is somewhat acknowledging that they did something wrong here in this case.
So they passed the tests for the diesels, but then they discovered that when it was in actual use, the emissions were beyond what they should have been, and that there's actually software that's causing that?
Right. And that was another thing that Marchionne was adamant about back in January, right? We have no defeat device. And I don't think you're hearing Fiat Chrysler full-throatedly denying that the way you heard back in January. And we didn't get to GM. I think there's the reason for the big gulf between GM and Fiat Chrysler is this is a consumer lawsuit, right? This is owners being represented by a law firm. Big difference. In the case of Fiat Chrysler, you did have owners initially, sue Fiat Chrysler, and that led to led to EPA getting involved. But we're a long way from GM seeing any sort of action on that front. We've yet to hear anything from EPA or Department of Justice about them having concerns with GM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a crucial difference, exactly what you're pointing out there. Hey, look, we got to get back to more, but we also got to take another quick break right now because we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking all about the news that's going on this week. What else you got there, Gary?
So I thought it was interesting that Geely, the company that owns Volvo, this week bought the Malaysian company, Proton, which is not that interesting to us, but it also took control of Lotus, which is of some interest to us. You know, and I started to think about this, and, you know, there's been discussions of, will the Chinese come to the American market? And isn't it possible that they'll come to the American market, you know, through a Swedish company, through a British company, and they'll just be here?
They're also arguably already here through GM, right? You have SUVs now coming in from China. I think that is probably a heck of a lot more likely because you don't have a situation where the consumer is even going to know or care once they do learn, oh, this Volvo is Chinese owned, so what? Mm-hmm. You have a much steeper curve to climb, right? If you're Great Wall or some of these other brands that in China are doing well these days, but here in America, nobody knows these brands, and nobody knows what to think about quality, right? We associate mm-hmm. China with cheap and not necessarily quality.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, that's right. And let's see what happens with what they can do with Lotus. I mean, Lotus, I don't know how they're still around, to be honest, from a business standpoint.
Right.
They've always done this brilliant engineering. They've always come up with the lightest weight vehicles. They've always had these very clever applications, and they have never made money. They're always getting bailed out. Mm-hmm. And now Geely's got them.
Which probably has a lot of money, which can bail them out.
Right. Now, I will say I greatly admire how Geely has handled Volvo.
I was gonna say
they've done a great job. They've let them be Volvo. Stay in Sweden, where it's going to be hands-off. So let's see what can happen with Lotus. I mean, I would love to see Lotus thrive and grow and really meet the promise that we've all felt the company had going back to the 1960s. But, man, they've never been able to break out of being just this little niche player that's just one step ahead of the tax bill collector.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were mentioning Tesla earlier, and the early Tesla Roadsters were based on the Lotus Elise.
Right.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, just to echo your point, John, I mean, the way that Geely has controlled Volvo, I mean, they've been a much better parent than I think Ford was back in the day. You've seen huge success with the way they've approached that. I think with Lotus, too, I mean, what's the risk if you're Geely? I mean, it's been a loss-making entity, but Geely is actually a pretty big company that... That does not, and backed by a billionaire in Li Shufu, they really have plenty of rope. I would think to be able to sort of do their thing. I wouldn't think that he would write them a blank check, but you know this has to be a big sigh of relief if you're a big Lotus fan because they're going nowhere now.
Yeah, they're going nowhere, and it'll be interesting to see how he uses them because. I've never driven a Proton. I don't know if they're any good. My sense is they're just kind of cheap little cars. Will Li Shufu say, hey, Lotus, go make Protons fantastic? And when you're done with that, come to China and help us make Geelys really good, or vice versa. But it'll be interesting to see how he uses it internally, because Lotus Engineering is, mm-hmm. they're damn good.
Right. And then there's the other... part of his empire, which is the forthcoming Link & Company, mm-hmm. which they'll be bringing out those new cars and the subscription model. What's your take on that?
I actually am not expecting that to us to see the light of or that to see the light of day here in the States. I think that maybe
ever?
Not at least for quite some time.
Weren't they talking 2019?
I thought they talked about bringing that brand out and considering it for North America, but the Chinese have been considering North America for years and years and always have said, yeah, we're 3 years away. And then 3 years later, they're 3 years away. So believe it when I see it. But that may be a brand that you'll see in Asia that maybe gets its footing. Maybe they'll try it in Europe. But you've even seen in Europe some, you know, the Chinese brands try to make a run in Europe and had real trouble. Let's face it, we're just very crowded, developed markets that are hard to break through. And really, it's all about the dealers here in the States, right? You have to have a dealer network. Suppose you could maybe find a way in with Volvo, but is it really worth that investment or risk to Volvo?
I think this is why they started that subscription service plan.
Mm.
You know, they've seen the wall of resistance against Tesla and thought, ooh, how do we do this differently? So we're not selling cars. We're providing you with a subscription service. And I think they're hoping that this is their workaround franchise laws. But, it'll be interesting to see if they come. And meanwhile, there's this new study that came out from this think tank that's out of Stanford University, group called Rethinks, that is saying all this move to ride-sharing with autonomous cars is going to drive the cost of transportation down so much, we're just not going to buy cars anymore. We're just going to buy rides as we need them, and that the industry as we know it is going to collapse by 2030. So, you know, if they're at all even directionally correct, you know, doing the subscription model thing, I don't know. I don't see it working.
All right, so I got to ask. So we had a discussion of fuel cells at the top of the show. We talked to Floyd about fuel cells a couple of weeks ago. Didn't we talk to somebody else about it? Oh, we had the Honda Clarity fuel cell in the studio. So
right.
A lot of fuel cell activity, right? And we're now hearing all of these lawsuits regarding diesels, okay? So what's your prediction of fuel cell vehicles in 10 years and diesel passenger vehicles in 10 years, not heavy-duty pickup truck or heavy-duty trucks, but where is it going to go? 10 years.
In the U.S.,
in the
globally.
US.
In the U.S., I think even if you see a situation where, like, you know, GM is exonerated, they don't have a problem with a defeat device, we're getting really close now to diesel being dead in the U.S. market. I mean, you saw just a few weeks ago Daimler say, you know what, forget it on certifying Mercedes-Benz in this market.
Of course, they're under investigation, too, for cheating.
You've had Mazda talk for years about how they'd like to bring diesel to this market. have not been able to do it. I mean, maybe the exception you have is GM bringing the Cruise diesel out and but, I mean, we're getting really close to diesel being done in this market. And I think as long as California retains power for sort of setting the environmental agenda, you're going to see more and more pressure to just, you know, just take that last breath and just take diesel out in this market. Fuel cells, I'm still very, very skeptical that they're going to catch on within the next 10 years because of just how difficult it's been, even in a market where they have so much support from the state of California, the difficulties they've had getting stations up and running in a quick way really says a lot, because I think we heard Sheldon talk about the East Coast and how that's been slow. California, you have one state, right, that is totally behind hydrogen and fuel cell. On the East Coast, you have a bunch of states, a bunch of different interests and governments that you have to appease and bring along through this process. I think it's going to be a slow roll outside of California for quite a while.
John?
Yeah, well, you know, your key question was passenger cars.
Right.
What's going to happen with passenger cars? And I would say diesels and passenger cars in the United States have no hope. Hydrogen fuel cells in passenger cars in 10 years, going to be a trickle. Now, what Sheldon was talking about for trucks, I think is a totally different story. And, you know, if we're going to greatly increase the price of diesels in trucks, whether it's medium and heavy duty pickups, class sixes all the way up through class eights, as that cost goes up and up and up, I think fuel cells will make more and more sense, more and more economic sense even. Because I buy the argument that, you know, a class eight full of enough batteries to have a long-haul capability. You know, when we had Mike O'Brien here from Hyundai, that was his argument. You're going to add a massive amount of weight. Now you're taking away the payload. You're adding all kinds of cost to it. And how long is it going to take to recharge, you know, a Class 8 full of batteries? So that's where I think fuel cells do start to make a whole lot of sense. And there's a lot of interesting research going on at NREL, the lab, you know, the National Renewable Energy Lab, of coming up with breakthroughs on how to produce hydrogen locally and, you know, at a lot lower cost. And when Larry Burns was, you know, the head of GM R&D, that's one of the things he pointed out is every building that you look at, including every gas station, has water. And he says, if we figure out a low-cost way of doing electrolysis, we make a hydrogen right there and then. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a lot of ifs, right? So, but going to your question, diesels, passenger cars, no way. Hydrogen, passenger cars, no way, not within a decade.
Okay, so a decade will be 2027. It'll be 2 years after the 2025, that if that stands. So does this mean Elon wins? The electric car is going to be the salvation for the auto company to be able to meet 54.5 miles per gallon?
I don't think so, in the sense that
the
internal combustion engine is a moving target. And it keeps getting better and better and better. And I remember talking to one engineer who said, you know, it costs $3,000 to hybridize a car. He says, let me spend $2,000 of that on my internal combustion engine, and I'll show you what I can really do. And when you look at a whole host of technologies, camless engines, electrically heated catalytic converters, and the biggie of them all, decarbonized gasoline or even decarbonized diesel fuel, where you can immediately shrink the carbon footprint that those cars put out, I think that the internal combustion engine will give batteries a real run for their money.
I think hybrid is where it's at for some time, and I kind of wonder to what extent the regulators will actually come back to that as the solution or the most practical way of not necessarily throwing in the towel of cleaning up emissions and making, you know, making big improvements in fuel economy. We still have a long way to go, and we've actually seen hybrids come back in terms of demand. But I think the only segment of sort of the alternative fuel market that has ever, you know, really registered with the U.S. consumer was the hybrid and the Prius back in its heyday. And I think Toyota showed that that was possible. I think Tesla and Elon have succeeded in telling a great story and sold a lot of cars to a lot of rich people. But I sort of wonder where the ceiling is for the mass market consumer at this point.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Gary?
I think that we're going to go from the historic monoculture of internal combustion engine only to a variety of solutions. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I mean, as you think about it, a car, as we know it, is with exceptions, has pretty much been a Swiss Army knife, right? You know, we want it to be able to do everything. You know, if I want to go to Traverse City right now, I can't do that in an electric car. I'd have to have a gasoline-powered car, a diesel-powered car, or a hybrid. You know, but so there will be vehicles that are more application specific for one's needs. And so just as we were talking about, okay, you have a depot and the thing's going around. Yeah, maybe that's your fuel cell car, you know, that you have this limited thing. If you have short runs, you know, maybe it's an electric car. You know, and if I want to go to Traverse City, maybe it's a gasoline powered car or it's a hybrid car. So I think we'll be able to see a multiplicity of solutions and that it will be economically viable, because I mean the thing we look at the end product, but you know manufacturing has gotten so much better, so there is the ability to flexibly make things without requiring the scale that you used to need.
Right. No, I agree with all that, but the real key for the industry is going to be, can you make any money on this? Because right. I'm told nobody makes money on hybrids, not on strong hybrids. We already know nobody makes money on electric cars. Fuel cells are way down the road from all that happening. So right now, the big automakers and Tesla are willing to lose money on all this stuff. I mean, they're talk about burning through shareholder value. They're burning through it. It's not sustainable. So if or until you can start turning a decent profit on these and return your cost of capital, not just make a variable profit on it, this is not sustainable. We're talking about sustainable cars that are not sustainable.
All right, but I would be surprised if Toyota is not making money off of Priuses.
Actually, it would be as well.
Right. I mean, and so, I mean, I think that, and that I think is an advantage that
now,
probably they took a beating.
Define profitability here, too, because if you're saying, okay, we're getting credits or this is allowing us to balance out the fleet to sell the cars that we really make money on, I would agree that they're making money.
Well,
but if you're talking on strictly bill of material and selling that thing for a profit,
I think they're doing it.
I think we forget about, you know, Japan is more of a market that everyone forgets about, but it is still actually a decent sized market. And you go to Japan and it is a sea of hybrids. It's a sea of Aquas, a sea of Priuses. I think they have reached the critical mass and the scale to where they can make money on that program, and it is probably a situation where if it weren't for Japan, you're absolutely right, John, that it would not be viable. But this market, you've seen it's incredible to me to see how far the Prius has fallen. I did give Toyota a lot of credit for showing the possibility of Prius and the demand for hybrid years ago. But you saw Toyota significantly redesign and improve the Prius, the old generation and the new generation. It's night and day, and yet you've seen demand crater for that. And it's really shocking to see that.
Well, one, it is a butt-ugly car. I'm sorry.
How do you really feel?
Well, no, I mean, you know, the last generation, to my eyes, looked a whole lot better than the new generation. I mean, the face of that car looks like it just bit into a lemon. You know, it just... And I'm not the only one saying this. I think that's a key reason why sales of the Prius have fallen so far, so fast. Now, it was falling before that, but the new one came out and pow, it really dropped.
Well, but RAV4 hybrid sales are just exploding. Mm-hmm. They're going through the roof.
Right.
And so they've got, it's the right type of car.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
it's, but it's probably Prius buyers moving into that.
Probably. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, so.
And it probably makes them happy because they're making more money off
right.
of it, right?
Now, if you look over the last 4 years, if you look at hybrids, plug-ins, and EVs, as a group, the segment is shrinking in the U.S. So even though plug-in sales are going up strong, EV sales are going up really strong, as a total segment, it's shrinking. And so what I'm seeing is people are coming out of their hybrids to buy those cars, but the segment as a total is not bringing in new buyers. And now, so far year to date, this year, it has increased a little bit. But, I mean, it's not a booming segment.
Difficult to put your money on that if you're Hao Tai Tang, right? I think you heard Mark Fields make that case on behalf of Ford, the exact one that you're making, John, of looking at what's happened to that share, and you have not seen a real signal that what the regulators envision in terms of where the consumer will be as long as the product is there, that math is just not working out. So, no.
Hey, look, we got to wrap this show up now, unfortunately. This is a great conversation. Craig, thanks so much for coming on. This has been great. We'll have to have you back again. This
thanks
is really
again.
Good.
For having me on.
And Gary, next week we've got this semi-dissident guy who used to be in the UAW and now is quitting. That'll be an interesting discussion.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. It ought to be good. And we invite all of you to join us then.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.